back and forth, clearing the thin rain. He turned on the radio and tuned in the all-news station in Wheeling. "Most city services have been shut down until further notice," the announcer said, "and I want to repeat that the 9 o'clock curfew will be strictly enforced."
"Good luck with that," the judge murmured.
"Now, recapping our top story. So-called blowtorch brigades, goaded by internet-fueled fake news that respiration exhaled through the growths, or cocoons, surrounding the sleeping women is spreading the Aurora Plague, have been reported in Charleston, Atlanta, Savannah, Dallas, Houston, New Orleans, and Tampa." The announcer paused, and when he resumed, his flat twang had become more pronounced, folksier. "Neighbors, I'm proud to say none of these ignorant mobs have been operating here in Wheeling. We all have women folks we love like mad, and killing them in their sleep, no matter how unnatural that sleep may be, would be a terrible thing to do." He pronounced terrible as terrible. Judge Silver's Land Rover was nearing the outer limits of Dueling's neighbor, Maylock. Rheingold's house in Coughlin was on the other side, a drive of another 20 minutes or so. "The National Guard has been called out in all the cities where those brigades have been at work, and they have orders to shoot to kill if those superstitious fools won't cease and desist. I say amen to that. The CDC has repeated that there is no truth whatsoever to..." The windshield was fogging up. Judge Silver leaned to his right, never taking his eyes from the road, and flipped on the defroster. The fan whooshed. On its wind, clouds of small brown moths spewed from the vents, filling the cabin and circling the judge's head. They lit in his hair and battered his cheeks. Worst of all, they spun before his eyes, and something one of his old aunts had told him long ago, when he was just an impressionable boy, recurred to him with the brilliance of a proven fact, like up is up and down is down. "Don't ever rub your eyes after touching a moth, Oscar," she had said. "The dust from their wings will get in there and you'll go blind." "Get away!" Judge Silver yelled. He took his hands off the wheel and beat at his face. Moths continued to pour from the vents, hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. The Land Rover's cabin became a swirling brown mist. "Get away! Get away! Get a-" A huge weight settled on the left side of his chest. Pain hammered down his left arm like electricity. He opened his mouth to cry out, and moths flew in, crawling on his tongue and tickling the lining of his cheeks. With his last struggling breath, he pulled them down his throat, where they clogged his windpipe. The Land Rover veered left, an approaching truck veered right just in time to avoid it, ending up in the ditch, canted but not quite toppling. There was no ditch to avoid on the other side of the road, just the guardrail separating the door's hollow bridge from the open air and the stream beneath. Silver's vehicle snapped the guardrails and pitched over. The Land Rover went end for end into the water below. Judge Silver, by then already dead, was ejected through the windshield and into Door's Hollow Stream, a tributary of Ball Creek. One of his loafers came off and floated downstream, shipping water and then sinking. The moths exited the overturned vehicle, now bubbling its way down into the water, and flew back toward Dueling in a flock. 8.
"I hated to do that," Eve said, speaking not to her guests, Clint felt, but to herself. She wiped a single tear from the corner of her left eye. "The more time I spend here, the more human I become. I had forgotten that."
"What are you talking about, Evie?" Clint asked. "What did you hate to do?"
"Judge Silver was trying to bring in outside help," she said. "It might not have made any difference, but I couldn't take the chance."
"Did you kill him?"
Angel asked, sounding interested.
"Use your special powers and all?"
"I had to. From this point forward, what happens in Dueling has to stay in Dueling."
"But," Michaela rubbed a hand down her face, "what's happening in Dueling is happening everywhere.
It's going to happen to me. Not for a while, Evie said. And you won't need any more stimulants, either. She extended a loose fist through the prison bars, extended a finger, and beckoned. Come to me.
I wouldn't do that, Rand said, as Garth overlapped him, saying, Don't be stupid, Mickey.
He grabbed her forearm. What do you think, Clint? Evie asked, smiling. Knowing he was giving in, not just to this, but to everything, Clint said, Let her go. Garth released his grip. As if hypnotized, Michaela took two steps forward. Evie put her face against the bars, her eyes on Michaela's, her lips parted.
Lesbo stuff, Angel crowed. Turn on the cameras, freaks, the muff diving comes next.
Michaela took no notice. She pressed her mouth to Evie's. They kissed with the hard bars of the soft cell between them, and Clint heard a sigh as Eve Black breathed into Michaela's mouth and lungs. At the same time, he felt the hairs stand up on his arms and neck. His vision blurred with tears. Somewhere, Jeanette was screaming, and Angel was cackling. At last, Evie broke the kiss and stepped back. Sweet mouth, she said. Sweet girl. How do you feel now? I'm awake, Michaela said. Her eyes were round, her recently kissed lips trembling. I'm really awake. There was no question that she was. The purple pouches beneath her eyes had disappeared, but that was the least of it. Her skin had tightened on her bones, and her formerly pallid cheeks had taken on a rosy glow. She turned to Garth, who was staring at her with slack-jawed amazement. I'm really, really awake. Holy shit, Garth said. I think you are. Clint darted his spread fingers at Michaela's face. She snapped her head away. Your reflexes are back, he said. You couldn't have done that 5 minutes ago. How long can I stay this way? Michaela clasped her shoulders, hugging herself. It's wonderful. A few days, Evie repeated. After that, the weariness will return, and with interest. You'll fall asleep no matter how much you struggle against it, and grow a cocoon like all the rest. Unless, that is... Unless you get what you want, Clint said. What I want is immaterial now, Evie said. I thought you understood that. It's what the men of this town do with me that matters. And what the women on the other side of the tree decide.
What?
Garth began. But then Jeanette hit him like a left tackle intent on sacking the quarterback, driving him into the bars. She shouldered him aside and grasped the bars, staring at Evie.
Do me. Evie, do me. I don't want to fight it no more. I don't want to see the Bud Man anymore, so do me.
Evie took her hands and looked at her sadly. I can't, Jeanette. You should stop fighting it and go to sleep like all the others. They could use someone as brave and strong as you are over there. They call it our place. It can be your place, too.
Please,
Jeanette whispered, but Evie let go of her hands. Jeanette staggered away, squashing spilled peas underfoot and crying soundlessly.
I don't know, Angel said thoughtfully. Maybe I won't kill you, Evie. I'm thinking maybe... I just don't know. You're spiritual. Plus, even crazier than me, which is going some.
Evie addressed Clint and the others again. Armed men will be coming. They want me because they think I may have caused Aurora, and if I caused it, I can put a stop to it. That's not exactly true. It's more complicated than that. Just because I turn something on by myself doesn't mean I can turn it off by myself. But do you think angry, frightened men would believe that?
Not in a million years, Garth Flickinger said.
Standing behind him, Billy Wettermore grunted agreement.
Evie said, They'll kill anyone who gets in their way. And when I'm not able to awaken their sleeping beauties with a wave of my fairy godmother magic wand, they'll kill me. Then they'll set fire to the prison and every woman in it just for spite.
Jeanette had wandered into the delousing area to resume her conversation with the bud man, but Angel was paying close attention. Clint could almost hear her mood lift, like a generator first thumping to life and then whirring into gear.
They ain't gonna kill me. Not without a fight.
For the first time, Evie looked piqued. Clint thought that whatever she'd done to awaken Mickey Coates might have drained her battery. Angel, they'll wash over you like a wave over a child's sandcastle.
Maybe, but I'll take a few with me.
Angel did a couple of rusty kung fu moves that made Clint feel an emotion he had never before associated with Angel Fitzroy. Pity.
Did you bring us here? Michaela asked. Her eyes were bright, fascinated. Did you draw us here, Garth and me?
No, Evie said. You don't understand how powerless I am. Little more than one of the drug man's rabbits hung on a line, waiting to be skinned or set free.
She turned her gaze fully on Clint.
Do you have a plan? I think you do.
Nothing so grand, Clint said. But I might be able to buy some time. We've got a fortified position here, but we could use a few more men.
What we could use, Tick interrupted, is a platoon of Marines.
Clint shook his head. Unless Terry Coombs and that guy Geary can get outside help, I think we can hold the prison with a dozen men, maybe as few as 10. Right now we number just 4. 5 if we can get Scott Hughes on board, but I don't hold out much hope of that.
Clint went on, speaking mostly to Mickey and the doc she'd brought with her. He didn't like the idea of sending Flickinger on a life-or-death mission. Nothing about how he looked or smelled disagreed with Evie's pronouncement that he was a big-time doper. But Flickinger and Janice Coates' daughter were all he had to work with.
The real problem is weaponry, and the big question is who lays hands on it first. I know from my wife that they've got quite the armory at the sheriff's station. Since 9/11 and all the domestic terrorism threats afterward, most towns dueling size do. For handguns, they've got Glock 17s and I think Lila said Sig something or others.
Sig Sauer, Billy Wettermore said. Good weapon.
They've got M4 semi-autos with those big clips, Clint went on, and a couple of Remington Model 700s. Also, I believe Lila said they have a 40mm grenade launcher.
Guns, Evie spoke to no one in particular. The perfect solution to any problem. The more you have, the more perfectly they solve the problem.
Are you shitting me? Michaela cried. A grenade launcher? Yes, but not for explosives. They use it with tear gas.
Don't forget the bulletproof vests, Rand sounded glum. Except at super close range, those things will stop a Mossberg slug, and the Mossies are the heaviest armament we've got.
This sounds like a punting situation, Tig remarked.
Billy Wettermore said, I sure don't want to kill anybody if I don't have to. Those are our friends, for God's sake.
Well, good luck, Evie said.
She went to her bunk and powered up Assistant Warden Hicks's phone.
I'm going to play a few games of Boomtown, then take a nap.
She smiled at Michaela.
I won't be taking any further questions from the press. You're a wonderful kisser, Mickey Coates, but you've worn me out.
Just watch that she don't decide to sick her rats on you,
Angel said to the group at large.
They do whatever she wants. It's how she got Hixie's cell phone.
Rats, Garth said. This keeps getting better.
I need you folks to come with me, Clint said. We need to talk, but it has to be quick. They'll have this place locked down soon enough.
Billy Wettermore pointed to Jeanette, now seated cross-legged in the shower alcove of the delousing station, and talking earnestly with someone only she could see.
What about Sorley?
She'll be fine, Clint said. Come on.
Go to sleep, Jeanette. Let yourself rest. Without looking at him, Jeanette said a single word.
No. 9. To Clint, the warden's office had an archaeological appearance, as if it had been abandoned for years instead of less than a week. Janice Coates lay on the couch, wrapped in her cerements of white. Michaela went to her and knelt down. She stroked the cocoon with one hand.
It gave off crackling sounds. Garth started to approach her, but Clint took his arm. Give her a minute, Dr. Flickinger. It was actually more like 3 before Michaela got to her feet. What can we do? She asked. Can you be persistent and persuasive? Clint asked. She fixed him with eyes that were no longer bloodshot. I came to News America as an unpaid intern at 23. By 26, I was a full-time correspondent, and they were talking about giving me my own evening show. She saw Billy giving a look to Tig and Rand and smiled at them. You know what they say around here, don't you? It ain't bragging if it's the truth. She returned her attention to Clint. Those are my references. Are they good enough?
I hope so, Clint said.
Listen. He talked for the next 5 minutes. There were questions, but not many. They were in a bad corner, and all of them knew it. Chapter 6 1 Alexander Peter Bear, the first baby to be born on the other side of the tree, son of a former dueling inmate named Linda Bear, breathed air for the first time a week after Lila and Tiffany returned from the wreck below Lionhead. It was another few days before Lila made his acquaintance at a small gathering in Elaine Nutting Geary's repaired home. He was not a traditionally attractive infant. The stacking of his many jowls produced an association not with the Gerber baby, but with a bookie that Lila had once arrested who had been known as Larry Large. However, baby Alexander had an irresistibly comic way of rolling his eyes around, as if he were anxiously attempting to gain his bearings amid the flowering of female faces that loomed above him. A plate of slightly crispy, though still pretty tasty, scones was passed around. Between bouts of the strange vertigo that afflicted her, Nadine Coombs had baked them in an outdoor oven. The oven itself had recently been hauled from the ruins of the Lowe's in Maylock using sledges and Tiffany's horses. It flabbergasted Lila sometimes, the rate of progress they were making, the speed and efficiency with which problems were solved and advancements made. At some point, Lila ended up with the baby. "Are you the last man on Earth or the first?" she asked him. Alexander Peter Bear yawned.
"Sorry, Lila, he doesn't talk to cops."
Tiffany had sidled up beside her in the corner of the living room.
"That so? We teach 'em young around here," Tiffany said.
Since their adventure, they'd become odd friends. Lila liked how Tiffany rode around town on her horses, wearing her white cowboy hat, insisting that children come over and stroke the animals' necks and see how soft and warm they were. 2 One day, with nothing better to do, Lila and Tiffany searched the dueling YMCA, not knowing exactly what they were looking for, only knowing it was one of the few places that hadn't been investigated. They found plenty of stuff, some of it interesting, but nothing they really needed. There was toilet paper, but supplies of that in the shop well were still plentiful. There were also cartons of liquid soap, but over the years it had hardened into pink bricks. The pool had dried up. Nothing remained but a faint, astringent odor of chlorine. The men's locker room was damp and dank. Luxuriant growths of mold, green, black, yellow, spanned the walls. A varmint's mummified corpse lay at the far end of the room, its legs stiff in the air, its face frozen in a savage death gape, lips stretched away from rows of sharp teeth. Lila and Tiffany stood for a moment in silent contemplation of the first urinal in a row of 6.
"Perfectly preserved," said Lila.
Tiffany gave her a quizzical look.
"That?"
pointing at the varmint.
"No, this."
Lila patted the top of the urinal, her wedding ring clicking against the porcelain.
"We'll want it for our museum.
We can call it the Museum of Lost Men."
"Ha," Tiffany said. "Tell you what, this is a scary fucking place. And believe me, that is saying something because I have toured some real dungeons. I mean, I could write you a guidebook of the sweaty, drafty, fucked up meth caves of Appalachia, but this is truly unpleasant. I knew men's locker rooms were creepy places,
but this is worse than I could ever have imagined. It was probably better before it got old, Lila said, but she wondered. They used hammers and chisels to break the combination locks off the lockers. Lila found stopped watches, wallets full of useless green paper and useless plastic rectangles, dead smartphones thus rendered stupid, key rings, moth-eaten trousers, and a caved-in basketball. Tiffany's haul wasn't much better. An almost full box of Tic Tacs and a faded photograph of a bald man with a hairy chest standing on a beach with his little laughing daughter perched on his shoulders.
Florida, I bet, Tiffany said. That's where they go if they got the scratch.
Probably. The photo made Lila think of her own son, which she increasingly felt was counterproductive, not that she could keep from doing it. Mary had filled her in on Clint, stalling to keep the officers at the prison, and Jared, hiding their bodies, our other bodies, she thought, in the attic of the show house up the street. Would she hear any more about either of them? A couple of other women had appeared since Mary, but none of them knew anything about her two guys, and why would they? Jared and Clint were on a spaceship, and the spaceship was getting farther and farther away, so many light years, and eventually they'd slip from the galaxy entirely, and that would be the end. Finito. When should she begin to mourn them? Had she already started?
Aw, said Tiffany. Don't.
What? But Tiffany had read her face somehow, seen right through to the hopelessness and the muddle.
Don't let it get you.
Lila returned the photo to its locker and shut the door. In the gymnasium upstairs, Tiffany challenged her to a game of horse. The prize was the almost full box of Tic Tacs. They pumped up the basketball. Neither of them had any talent for the game. Clint's daughter, who had turned out to not be his daughter, would have dispatched them both with ease. Tiffany shot everything granny style, underhanded, which Lila found annoyingly girly but also cute. When she had her coat off, you could see her pregnant stomach protrude, a bulb at Tiffany's waist.
Why dueling? Why us? Those are the questions, wouldn't you say?
Lila trotted after the basketball. Tiffany had shot it into the dusty bleachers to the right of the court.
I've got a theory.
You do? Let's have it.
Lila hurled the basketball from the bleachers. It missed the basket by a couple of car lengths and bounced into the second row of the opposite set of bleachers.
That was pathetic, Tiffany said.
You're one to talk. I'll admit that. We've got a couple of doctors and a few nurses. We've got a veterinarian. We've got a bunch of teachers. Kaylee knew her way around a circuit, and although she's gone, Magda isn't bad. We've got a carpenter. We've got a couple of musicians. We've got a sociologist who's already writing a book about the new society.
Yeah, and when it's done, Molly can print it with her berry juice ink,
Tiffany snickered. We've got that retired engineering professor from the university. We've got seamstresses and gardeners and cooks out the yin-yang. The book club ladies are running an encounter group so women can talk about the stuff they miss and get out some of the sadness and grief. We've even got a horse whisperer. See?
Tiffany retrieved the basketball. See what? We're all we need, Lila said.
She had descended from the bleachers and stood with her arms crossed at the baseline of the court.
That's why we were chosen. Every basic skill we need to survive is here. Okay, maybe. Could be. Sounds about right to me.
Tiffany took off her cowboy hat and fanned herself with it. She was plainly amused.
You are such a cop. Solving the mysteries.
Lila wasn't done, though. So how do we keep things going? We've already got our first baby. And how many pregnant women are there? A dozen? Eight?
Could be as many as 10. That enough to jumpstart a new world, you think? When half of them's apt to be girls?
I don't know. Lila was riffing now, her face feeling hot as ideas came to her.
But it's a start.
And I bet you there's cold storage facilities with generators that were programmed to run and run and are still running.
You'd have to go to a city to find one, I'd guess, but I bet you could. And there would be frozen sperm samples there. And that would be enough to get a world, a new world, going.
Tiffany stuck her hat on the back of her head and thumped the basketball off the floor a couple of times.
New world, huh?
She could have planned it this way. The woman, Eve, so we could start over again without men. At least at the beginning, Lila said.
Garden of Eden with no Adam, huh? Okay, Chief, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Is it a good plan, what that woman set up for us?
A fair question, Lila thought. The inhabitants of our place had discussed Eve Black endlessly. The rumors that had started in the old world had been carried into the new world. It was a rare meeting when her name, if it was her name, did not come up. She was an extension and a possible answer to the original questions, the great how and why of their situation. They discussed the likelihood that she was something more than a woman, more than human, and there was increasing unity in the belief that she was the source of everything that had happened. On the one hand, Lila mourned the lives that had been lost, Millie, Nell, Kaylee, Jessica Elway before them, and how many others, as well as the histories and existences from which those that still lived had been separated. Their men and boys were gone. Yet most, Lila definitely among them, could not deny the renewal before them. Tiffany Jones with full cheeks and clean hair and a second heartbeat. In the old world, there were men who had hurt Tiff, and badly. In the old world, there were men who burned women, thus incinerating them in both realities. Blowtorch brigades, Mary said they were being called. There were bad women and there were bad men. If anyone could claim the right to make that statement, Lila, who had arrested plenty of both, felt that she could. But men fought more. They killed more. That was one way in which the sexes had never been equal. They were not equally dangerous. So yes, Lila thought it was probably a good plan. Merciless, but very good. A world restarted by women had a chance to be safer and fairer. And yet, I don't know. Lila couldn't say that an existence without her son was better. She could conceptualize the idea, but she couldn't articulate it without feeling like a traitor to both Jared and to her old life. Tiffany nodded.
How about this, then? Can you shoot backwards?
She turned away from the basket, bent her knees low, and flipped the ball over her head. It went up, caromed off the corner of the square, caught the rim, and fell off. Bounce, bounce, bounce. So close. 3. An ochre gush belched from the tap. A pipe clanked loudly against another pipe. The brownish flow sputtered, stopped, and then, hallelujah, clean water began to pour into the sink.
Well, said Magda Dubcek to the small assembly around the work sink set against the wall of the water treatment plant. There it is.
Incredible, said Janice Coates.
Nah, pressure, gravity, not so complex. We be careful, turn on one neighborhood each at a time. Slow but steady, win the race.
Lila, thinking of the ancient note from Magda's son Anton, undoubtedly a dope and a coxman, but pretty damn sharp about the ways of water in his own right, abruptly hugged the old lady.
Oh, said Magda. All right. Thanks.
The water echoed in the long room of the Dueling County Water District plant, hushing them all. In silence, the women took turns passing their hands through the fresh stream. 4. One of the things everyone missed was the ability to just jump in a car and drive somewhere instead of walking and getting blisters. The cars were still there, some in pretty good shape from being parked in garages, and at least some of the batteries they found in storage still held juice. The real problem was gasoline. Every drop had oxidized during the in-between period.
We'll have to refine some,
the retired engineering professor explained at a committee meeting. Not more than 150 miles distant, in Kentucky,
There were storage wells and refineries that might be restarted with work and luck. They immediately began to plan another journey. They assigned tasks and selected volunteers. Lila scanned the women in the room for signs of misgivings. There were none. Among the faces, she took special note of Celia Frode, the only survivor of the exploration party. Celia nodded along with the rest of them.
"Put me on that list," Celia said. "I'll go. Feel a need to put on my rambling shoes."
It would be risky, but they would be more careful this time. And they would not flinch. 5. When they got to the second floor of the demo house, Tiffany announced that she wasn't climbing the ladder to the attic.
"I'll wait here."
"If you're not coming up, why'd you come at all?" Lila asked. "You're not that pregnant."
"I was hoping you'd give me some of your Tic Tacs, ringer.
And I'm plenty pregnant enough, believe me." Lila had one horse and the mints. "Here." She tossed the box to Tiffany and climbed up the ladder. The Pine Hills show house had, ironically, proved to be better constructed than almost every other structure on Tremaine, including Lila's own. Although dim, small windows smudged by the passage of seasons, the attic was dry. Lila paced the space, her footfalls drawing puffs of dust from the floor. Mary had said that this was the one where she and Lila and Mrs. Ransom were, back there, wherever back there was. She wanted to feel herself, to feel her son. She didn't feel anything. At one end of the attic, a moth was batting against one of the dirty windows. Lila walked over to release it. The window was stuck. Lila heard creaking as, behind her, Tiffany climbed the ladder. She moved Lila aside, took out a pocket knife, worked the point around the edges, and the window went up. The moth escaped and flew away. Below, there was snow on the overgrown lawns, on the busted-up street, on her dead cruiser in Mrs. Ransom's driveway. Tiffany's horses were poking their noses around, nickering about whatever it was that horses nickered about, switching their tails. Lila could see past her own house, past the pool that she had never wanted and that Anton had tended, and past the elm tree that he had left her the note about. An orange animal trotted from the shadowy edge of the pine woods that backed the neighborhood. It was a fox. Even at this distance, the luster of its winter coat was evident. How had it got to be winter so soon? Tiffany stood in the middle of the attic. It was dry, but also cold, especially with the window open. She held out the box of Tic Tacs for Lila to take back.
"I wanted to eat them all, but it would have been wrong. I've given up my life of crime."
Lila smiled and put them back in her own pocket. "I declare you rehabilitated." The women stood about a foot apart, looking at each other, breathing steam. Tiffany pulled off her hat and dropped it on the floor.
"If you think that's a joke, it's not. I don't want to take anything from you, Lila. I don't want to take anything from anybody."
"What do you want?" asked Lila.
"My very own life. Baby and a place and stuff. People that love me."
Lila closed her eyes. She'd had all those things. She couldn't feel Jared, couldn't feel Clint, but she could remember them, could remember her very own life. It hurt, those memories. They made shapes in the snow, like the angels they'd made as children, but those shapes became fuzzier every day. God, she was lonesome. "That's not so much," Lila said, and reopened her eyes.
"It seems like a lot to me."
Tiffany reached out and drew Lila's face to hers. 6. The fox trotted away from the Pine Hills development, across Tremaine Street, and into the thick stands of winter wheat that had grown up on the far side. He was hunting for the smell of hibernating ground squirrels. The fox loved ground squirrels. Crunchy, juicy. And on this side of the tree, unbothered for so long by human habitation, they had grown careless.
After a half hour's search, he discovered a little family of them in a dugout chamber. They never awoke, even as he was crushing them between his teeth. "So tasty," he said to himself. The fox went on, entering the deep woods, making for the tree. He paused briefly to explore an abandoned house. He pissed on a pile of books scattered on the floor and nosed fruitlessly around in a closet full of rotting linens. In the kitchen of the house, there was food in the refrigerator that smelled deliciously spoiled, but his attempts to bump the door ajar accomplished nothing. "Let me in there," the fox demanded of the fridge, just in case it was only pretending to be a dead thing. The fridge loomed, unresponsive. A copperhead slid out from under the wood stove on the far side of the kitchen.
"Why are you glowing?" it asked the fox.
Other animals had commented on this phenomenon and were wary of it. The fox saw it himself when he looked into still water and saw his reflection. A gold light clung to him. It was her mark. "I've had some good fortune," the fox said. The copperhead wriggled its tongue at him.
"Come here. Let me bite you."
The fox ran from the cabin. Various birds heckled him as he loped beneath the canopy of gnarled and tangled bare branches, but their petty jibes meant nothing to the fox, whose belly was full and whose coat was thick as a bear's. When he emerged into the clearing, the tree was there, the centerpiece of a leafy, steaming oasis in the fields of snow. His paws crossed over from the cold ground to the rich, warm summer loam that was the tree's forever bed. The tree's branches were layered and blended in countless greens, and beside the passage in the bowl, the white tiger, flicking its great tail, watched him approach with sleepy eyes. "Don't mind me," said the fox. "Just passing through." He darted by, into the black hole, and out the opposite side. Chapter 7 1 Don Peters and Eric Blass had yet to be relieved at the West Lavin roadblock when a banged-up Mercedes SL600 came trundling toward them from the prison. Don was standing in the weeds, shaking off after a leak. He zipped up in a hurry and returned to the pickup that served as their cruiser. Eric was standing in the road with his gun drawn. "Stow the cannon, Junior," Don said, and Eric holstered his Glock. The driver of the Mercedes, a curly-haired man with a florid face, pulled to an obedient stop when Don raised his hand. Sitting beside him was a good-looking woman. Make that astoundingly good-looking, especially after all the zombie chicks he and Eric had seen the last few days. Also, she was familiar. "License and registration," Don said. He had no orders to look at drivers' IDs, but it was what cops said when they made a stop. "Watch this, Junior," he thought. "See how a man does it." The driver handed over his license. The woman rooted around in the glove compartment and found the registration. The man was Garth Flickinger, M.D., from Dueling, with a listed residence in the town's fanciest neighborhood, over on Briar.
"Mind telling me what you were doing up at the prison?"
"That was my idea, officer," the woman said. God, she was good-looking. No bags under this bitch's eyes. Don wondered what she'd been taking to keep her so bushy-tailed.
"I'm Michaela Morgan, from News America," Eric exclaimed. "I knew I recognized you."
It meant jack shit to Don, who didn't watch network news, let alone the blah-blah crap they put out 24/7 on the cable, but he remembered where he'd seen her.
"Right, the squeaky wheel. You were drinking there."
She gave him a high-voltage smile, all capped teeth and high cheekbones.
"That's right. A man gave a speech about how God was punishing women for wearing pants. It was very interesting."
Eric said,
"Could I have your autograph? It would be something cool to have after you..."
He stopped in confusion. "After I fall asleep," she said. "I think the bottom may have fallen out of the autograph market, at least temporarily. But if Garth, Dr. Flickinger,
has got a pen in his glove compartment, I don't see why...
Forget that, Don said harshly. He was embarrassed by his young partner's lack of professionalism. I want to know why you were up at the prison, and you aren't going anywhere until you tell me.
Of course, officer. She spotlighted him with her smile again. Although my professional name is Morgan, my real name is Coates, and I'm from right here in town. In fact, the warden is...
Coates is your mother?
Don was shocked. But once you got past her nose, which was arrow sharp while old Janice's honker was crooked, he could see the resemblance.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but your mother isn't with us anymore.
I know. No smile now. Dr. Norcross told me. We spoke to him on the intercom.
The man is an asshole,
the Flickinger guy said. Don grinned, just couldn't help it.
I'll double down on that.
He handed back the paperwork.
Wouldn't let her in,
Flickinger marveled.
Wouldn't even let her say goodbye to her own mother.
Well, Michaela said, the complete truth is that wasn't the only reason I persuaded Garth to take me up there. I also wanted an interview with a woman named Eve Black. I'm sure you've heard the chatter about how she sleeps and wakes. It would have been quite a scoop, you know. The outside world doesn't care about much these days, but it would care about that. Only Norcross said she was inside a cocoon, like all the rest of the inmates. Don felt compelled to set her straight. Women, even women reporters, it seemed, could be painfully gullible.
Pure bullshit, and everybody knows it. She's different, special, and he's holding on to her for some crazy reason of his own. But that's going to change.
He dropped her a wink, ponderous enough to include Garth, who winked back.
Be nice to me, and I might get you that interview once we spring her.
Michaela giggled.
I better look in your trunk, I guess, Don said. Just so I can say I did.
Garth got out and wrenched open his trunk, which rose with a weary squall. Geary had taken a few swipes here as well. He hoped this clown wouldn't check beneath the spare tire. It was where he had sequestered the baggie of purple lightning. The clown didn't bother. Just took a quick look and gave a nod. Garth closed the trunk. This produced an even louder squall, the sound of a cat with its paw caught in a door.
What happened to your car?
Eric asked as Garth got back behind the wheel. Garth opened his mouth to tell the lad that a crazed animal control officer had laid into it, then remembered the crazed animal control officer was now, according to Norcross, the acting sheriff.
Kids, he said. Vandals. They see something nice and they just want to destroy it, don't they?
The clown bent down to look at the pretty lady.
I'm heading down to the squeak when my shift is over. If you're still awake, I'd love to buy you a drink.
That would be wonderful, Michaela said, just as if she meant it.
You guys drive carefully and have a good evening, the clown said.
Garth dropped the transmission into drive, but before he could turn onto the main road, the kid shouted,
Wait!
Garth stopped. The kid was bending down, hands on his knees, looking at Michaela.
How about that autograph?
There was a pen in the glove compartment, it turned out. A nice one with Garth Flickinger, M.D. stamped in gold on the barrel. Michaela scribbled, To Eric with best wishes, on the back of a drug rep's business card and handed it over. Garth got rolling while the kid was still thanking her. Less than a mile down Route 31 toward town, they spotted a town cruiser coming toward them, moving fast. Slow down, Michaela said. As soon as the cruiser disappeared over the hill behind them, she told him to step on it. Garth did. 2. For 2 years, Lila had pestered Clint to add her various contacts to his own in case of trouble at the prison. 6 months ago, he had finally done it, mostly to get her off his case, and now he thanked God for her persistence. First, he called Jared and told him to sit tight. If all went well, he told his son, someone would be along to pick him up before dark, possibly in an RV. Then he closed his eyes, said a brief prayer for eloquence, and called the lawyer who had facilitated Eve Black's transfer to the prison. After 5 rings, as Clint was resigning himself to voicemail,
Barry Holden answered.
Holden here.
He sounded uninterested and exhausted. This is Clint Norcross, Barry, up at the prison.
Clint?
No more than that. I need you to listen to me, very carefully. Nothing from Barry Holden.
Are you there?
After a pause, Barry replied in that same uninterested voice.
I'm here.
Where are Clara and your daughters? Four girls, ages 12 to 3. A terrible thing for the father who loved them, but maybe a good thing for Clint, awful as that was to think of. He didn't have to talk about the fate of the world, only about the fate of Barry's female hostages to fortune.
Upstairs, sleeping.
Barry laughed. Not a real laugh, though, just ha-ha-ha, like a dialogue balloon in a comic book.
Well, you know, wrapped up in those things. I'm in the living room with a shotgun. If anybody shows up here with so much as a lit match, I'm gonna blow them away.
I think there might be a way to save your family. I think they could wake up. Does that idea interest you?
Is it the woman?
Something new crept into Barry's voice. Something alive. Is it true, what they're saying? That she can sleep and then wake up?
If it's only a rumor, be straight with me. I can't stand to hope unless there's a reason to.
It's true. Now listen. Two people are coming to see you. One's a doctor, the other is Warden Coates' daughter.
Michaela's still awake, even after all this time?
Barry had begun to sound like his old self.
Not impossible, I guess. Gerda, my eldest, held out until last night, but still pretty remarkable.
She's not just awake. She's totally awake, unlike every other woman in the Tri-Counties who's still got her eyes open. The woman we've got in custody up here did it. Just breathed down her throat and woke her up.
If this is a joke, Norcross, it's an extremely bad
You'll see for yourself. They're going to tell you everything, then ask you to do some pretty dangerous stuff. I don't want to say you're our only hope, but... Clint closed his eyes, rubbed at his temple with his free hand. But that might be what you are, and time is very short.
I would do anything for my wife and girls, Barry said.
Anything. Clint allowed himself a long exhalation of relief. Buddy, I was hoping you'd say that.
3.
Barry Holden did indeed have a shotgun. It wasn't new, having been handed down through 3 generations of Holdens, but he had cleaned it and oiled it, and it looked lethal enough. He listened to Garth and Michaela with it laid across his thighs. Beside him, on an end table decorated with one of Clara Holden's lace doilies, was an open box of fat red shells. Talking turn and turn about, Michaela and Garth told the lawyer what Clint had told them. How Eve Black's arrival roughly coincided with Aurora's first reported victims, how she had killed 2 men with her bare hands, how she had allowed herself to be taken into custody without a struggle, saying it was what she wanted, how she had banged her face repeatedly into the protective mesh of Lila's cruiser, how the bruises had healed with magical speed. Besides fixing me up, she knew things about me she couldn't possibly have known, Michaela said. And they say she can control the rats. I know that's hard to believe, but... Garth interrupted.
Another prisoner, Fitzroy, told us she used rats to get the assistant warden's cell phone. And she does have a cell phone. I saw it.
There's more, Michaela said. She claims to have killed Judge Silver. She claimed... She paused, reluctant to say it. But Clint had told them to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Remember that he may be grieving, Clint had said, but he's still a lawyer and a damned good one. He can smell a lie at 40 yards, even upwind.
She claimed she did it using moths, because Silver was trying to bring in someone from out of town, and that's not allowed.
Michaela knew that a week ago, this was where Barry Holden would have decided they were either sharing a pernicious delusion or trying on the world's worst and most stoned prank, and invited them to leave his house. But it wasn't a week ago. Instead of telling them to get out, Barry handed his grandfather's shotgun to Michaela. "Hold this." There was a laptop on the coffee table. Barry sat on the couch, also liberally decorated with his wife's needlework, and began tapping away. After a moment, he looked up. "Bridger County Police are reporting an accident on the old Coughlin Road. One fatality. No name, but the vehicle was a Land Rover. Judge Silver drives a Land Rover." He regarded Michaela Coates. What they were telling him, essentially, was that the fate of every woman on planet Earth depended on what happened here in Dueling over the next few days. It was mad, but Warden Coates' daughter, sitting there in Clara's favorite Bentwood rocker and looking at him earnestly, was the best argument that it was true. Possibly an irrefutable argument. A news report on CNN that morning had said that less than 10% of the world's women were estimated to still be awake on Aurora Day 5. Barry didn't know about that, but he would have been willing to bet Grandpa Holden's shotgun that none of them looked like Michaela. "She just, what, kissed you? Like when the prince kissed Princess Aurora in the cartoon?" "Yes," said Michaela. "Like that. And she breathed down my throat. I think that's what really did it. Her breath." Barry switched his attention to Garth. "You saw this?" "Yes, it was amazing. Mickey here looked like a vampire after a fresh transfusion." And when he caught Michaela's frowning stare, "Sorry, darling, maybe not the best metaphor." "That was actually a simile," she said coldly. Barry was still trying to get his mind around it. "And she says they'll come for her, the cops, the townies, and that Frank Geary's in charge?" "Yes." Michaela had left out everything Evie had said about the sleeping women having to make their own decision. Even if true, that part was out of their hands. "I know Geary," Barry said. "I never defended him, but he's been in district court a couple of times. I remember a case where a woman complained that he threatened her for not keeping her Rottweiler on a leash. He has what you'd call anger issues." "Tell me about it," Garth murmured. Barry looked at him, eyebrows raised. "Never mind," Garth said. "Not important." Barry took back his shotgun. "Okay, I'm in. For one thing, I've got nothing else to do with Clara and the girls gone. For another, I want to see this mystery woman with my own eyes. What does Clint want from me?" "He said you have a Winnebago," Michaela said, "to go camping in with your wife and girls." Barry smiled. "Not a Winnebago, a Fiesta. Sucks a ton of gas, but it sleeps six. The girls squabble almost nonstop, but we had some good times in that old thing." His eyes abruptly filled with tears. "Some very, very good times." 4. Barry Holden's Fleetwood Fiesta was parked in a small lot behind the old-fashioned granite block of a building where he kept his office. The RV was a monstrous, zebra-striped thing. Barry sat behind the wheel while Michaela climbed into the passenger seat. They waited for Garth to reconnoiter the cop shop. The Holden family's heirloom shotgun lay on the floor between them. "Does this have any chance at all, do you think?" Barry asked. "I don't know," Michaela replied. "I hope so, but I really don't know." "Well, it's nuts, no doubt about that," Barry said. "But it beats sitting home and thinking bad thoughts." "You have to see Evie Black to really understand. Speak to her. You have to..." She searched for the right word. "You have to experience her. She..." Michaela's cell phone rang. It was Garth. "There's a geezer with a beard sitting under an umbrella on one of the benches out front, but otherwise the coast is clear. No cruisers in the side lot, just a few personal vehicles. If we're going to do this, I think we better hurry up. That RV is not what I'd call unobtrusive." "Coming now," Michaela said. She ended the call. The alley between Barry's building and the one next to it was narrow. There couldn't have been more than 5 inches of clearance for the lumbering Fleetwood on either side. But Barry threaded its length with the ease of long experience. He stopped at the mouth of the alley, but Main Street was deserted. It's almost as if the men are gone too, Michaela thought as Barry made a wide right turn and drove the two blocks to the municipal building. He parked the Fleetwood in front, taking three spaces marked official business only, others will be towed. They got out and Garth joined them. The man with the beard got up and ambled over, holding the umbrella over his head. The stem of a pipe poked up from the bib of his Oshkosh overalls. He held out his hand to Barry and said,
"Hello there, counselor."
Barry shook with him. "Hey, Willie, good to see you, but I can't stop to chew the fat. We're in sort of a hurry. Urgent business." Willie nodded.
"I'm waiting for Lila. I know the chances are good that she's asleep, but I'm hoping not. Want to talk to her. I went back out to that trailer where those meth heads got killed. Something funny out there. Not just fairy handkerchiefs. The trees are full of moths. Wanted to talk to her about it, maybe take her to see. If not her, then whoever's supposed to be in charge."
"This is Willie Burke," Barry told Garth and Michaela. "Volunteer fire department, adopt a highway, coaches Pop Warner, all around good guy. But we're really pressed for time, Willie, so if it was Lenny Mars you came to talk to, you better hurry up." Willie's eyes flicked from Barry to Garth to Michaela. They were deep set, caught in nets of wrinkles, but sharp.
"She was still awake the last time I popped in, but she's fading fast."
"No deputies around?" Garth asked.
"Nope, all out on patrol. Except maybe for Terry Coombs. I heard he's a little under the weather. Struck drunk, don't you know?"
The three of them started up the steps to the triple doors.
"Haven't seen Lila then?"
Willie called after them.
"No," Barry said. "Well, maybe I'll wait a little longer."
And Willie wandered back to his bench.
"Something funny out there, all right. All those moths. And the place has got a vibration."
5. Lenny Mars, part of the 10% of Earth's female population still holding out on that Monday, continued to walk around with her laptop, but now she was moving slowly, occasionally stumbling and bumping into the furniture. To Michaela, she looked like a wind-up toy that had almost run down. 2 hours ago, that was me, she thought. Lenny walked past them, staring at her laptop with her bloodshot eyes, not seeming to realize they were there until Barry tapped her on the shoulder. Then she jumped, her hands flying up. Garth caught her laptop before it could crash to the floor. On the screen was a video of the London Eye. In slow motion, it tottered and rolled into the Thames again and again. Hard to tell why anyone would want to destroy the London Eye, but apparently someone had felt a need to do so.
"Barry, you scared the dickens out of me."
"I'm sorry," he said. "Terry sent me to get some of the hardware from the weapons room. I guess he wants it up to the prison. May I have the key, please?"
"Terry," she frowned. "Why would he? Lila's the sheriff, not Terry. You know that."
"Lila, right," Barry said. "It's Lila's order via Terry." Garth went to the doors and looked out, convinced that a sheriff's department cruiser would pull up at any moment. Maybe two or three. They would be thrown in jail, and this lunatic adventure would be over before it even got started. So far, there was no one but the bearded guy sitting out there under his umbrella, like patience on her monument. But that couldn't last. "Can you help me out, Lenny? For Lila?"
"Sure, I'll be glad to see you're back," Lenny said.
She went to her desk and put her laptop down. On the screen, the London Eye fell and fell and fell.
"That guy Dave is running things until she does. Or maybe his name is Pete. Confusing to have two Petes around. In any case, I don't know about him. He's very serious."
She rummaged in her wide top drawer and brought out a heavy ring of keys. She peered at them. Her eyes drifted closed. White threads immediately rose from her eyelashes, wavering in the air. "Lenny," Barry said sharply, "wake up." Her eyes snapped open and the threads disappeared.
"I am awake. Stop shouting."
She ran a finger along the keys, making them jingle.
"I know it's one of them."
Barry took them. I'll find it. Miss Morgan, maybe you'd like to go back to the RV and wait there.
No, thanks. I want to help. It will be quicker that way.
At the back of the main room was an unmarked metal door painted a particularly unappetizing shade of green. There were two locks.